Welcome to Nashville to Memphis, a podcast hosted by Dr. Jason Lee McKinney, a recording artist, songwriter, and the rock star professor. N2M is a podcast where Jason and a guest or two literally talk on the phone while Jason is driving down I-40. The only subject criteria is that this podcast is all about the random crap Jason thinks about. So, all of you podcasters and audiophiles, just chill on the sound quality, you dig? Jason is a front pocket theologian, back pocket socio-philosopher, and a jockstrap surveyor of the music industry. You may not be able to make sense of it all, but that's okay. Neither can he. Thanks for listening to Nashville to Memphis. Don't forget to rate and write a review for the podcast on iTunes. You can find it under the title Nashville to Memphis. You can reach the podcast at www.facebook.com/Nashville to Memphis. And check out Jason's music at www.jasonleemckinneyband.com, as well as iTunes and Spotify under Jason Lee McKinney Band.
This week on N2M, I chat with producer, engineer extraordinaire Kevin Houston. Kevin has worked with the likes of Robert Plant, Patty Griffin, the North Mississippi All-Stars, Buddy Guy, Walter Trout, Lucero, Southern Avenue, and most importantly, the Jason Lee McKinney Band. Kevin and I talk about his journey in the music business, how the industry has changed, and what it takes to not only thrive, but even survive in the long haul. So sit back, buckle up, and adjust the rear view. You're listening to Nashville to Memphis.
So anyway, so kind of tell me, what was the first point in your life that you were thinking, hey, I think I'm going to go into music? Mine was when I saw Purple Rain. I went back and rewatched it, and it's a horrible, horrible movie. The music stands up. The movie doesn't. The acting does not stand up to half the time.
You know, I guess for me, like a lot of people, I remember being in church as a kid and fascinated with the music, the singing, and the pianist and organist we had, Southern Baptist Church in Memphis. And so that sort of got me going, and I started singing as a kid, in church and, choir at school. And, then I started playing saxophone and guitar about the same time, around sixth grade when I turned 12, started a beginner band, and, picked up, got a guitar for my birthday and started taking lessons. And, so I just sort of, you know, I had the curse early on, and, I guess it wasn't until I met Luther and Cody Dickinson that I actually thought, wow, that I could do something in music. You know, it was always something I wanted to do, but I met them when I was 15, and there was a great example of, hey, here's, you know, in Jim Dickinson, a man who is in my community supporting his family through music. And that sort of also kind of started me along the path of, you know, finding out about the studio and, what a producer was and, what an engineer was and that whole world. So, you know, the seeds were sown early on, but I guess, you know, sometime between 12 and 15, I got really, really interested in it. And then when I met them, I started to see, hey, I this could be something I could do.
Right. Man, what an amazing blessing that was, because I grew up in small town Indiana. Nobody knew anything. I guess the only thing I could compare it to is I met Andy Simmons, like the guitar virtuoso shredder dude. Cool. He still is like big on the whole Steve Vai kind of circuit deal.
But awesome.
He was the only one out of my hometown that had really done anything, and he left. Like there was no
right.
Delusion of staying in my
right.
area. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So
right.
It was a total different experience. So I have a couple of follow-up questions on that. You didn't start with the recorder, the school recorder?
No, I guess the, you know, my first, I remember my first sort of playing around with audio was, you know, we had a cassette recorder, just a basic, you know, old school, you know, big buttons,
right,
Panasonic cassette recorder. And I remember making sort of little mixtapes and comedy reels. I remember as a little kid, I had this imaginary radio station going on in my head, and I would DJ and sing the songs and imagine the songs and do everything. And so once I got the little cassette recorder, I would, you know, with my friends, we would take some 45s and, you know, play them in the background and, you know, pretend we were, a band in my, and you turn off all the lights. I had a black light and turn that on and, you know, just get all weird. And, and then I remember, we had, when my folks got a VCR, like, we were one of the first people in the Cove that got a VCR, and it had an audio dub feature. So I could like overdub over like, you know, Star Wars or something, you know,
right,
something that I record that would come on at night or something. And then I would record my own little soundtrack. And so that also kind of got me thinking about, you know, film stuff. And, and then it was four tracks, you know,
right,
four tracks. And I went to, once I had four tracks, it was like, oh man, this is incredible. You could flip the tape and do backwards stuff and, you know, all kinds of crazy stuff. And then when I met Luther and Cody, their dad was a producer and they had an 8-track reel to reel. And I was like, wow, there's four more tracks. I mean,
right,
this is amazing. We can do like all kinds of stuff now. Which seems really silly now. I mean, you know, anybody with a laptop has unlimited tracks. And, but I think there's something, you know, the Beatles started with four tracks, and there's something really creative about limitations.
Yeah, man, I will say, Kevin, you just dated yourself because you just said VCR and 45.
That's right. That's right, man. I'm a child of the 70s and 80s.
Well, since you're a sax player, this is kind of off the subject, but I've always had this curious question. Why did 80s music have the random sax solo that often happened? And there was no sax part. There was no horns.
Right.
But like 2 minutes and 15 seconds into the song, there'd be the random sax solo out of nowhere.
I don't know, man. I don't know. That's a good question. You know, you got the gated snare reverb and the sax solo, the ubiquitous sax solo.
Yeah. Funny. So what was your sort of first foray into like the professional? When did you really get into engineering professionally? Was it right after college or?
You know, I was in a band with Luther and Cody, and this is, I guess, was my senior year in high school and then my freshman year in college. And I went to the University of Memphis and I was playing saxophone. So I was going on a band scholarship and I just majored in saxophone performance. But I quickly realized the only thing I could do with that kind of degree was teach band, or at least that's what I thought. And then I found out that they had a recording program. Around that time, Luther and Cody met Paul Taylor, who's an incredible musician, and I was immediately kicked out of the band. And I found the studio, and so we all still remain friends, of course. And so they were sort of my guinea pig in the studio. We had jumped up to a 2-inch 24-track machine at the University of Memphis, and I would always take the late shifts. Like nobody else wanted the 10 o'clock to 8 a.m., 10 p.m. to 8 a.m. slot, but that was the time you could get the most amount of hours. Luther, Cody, and Paul and I would go and spend all sorts of hours in the University of Memphis studio and vandalize the surrounding areas and just make recordings. And so once I got into that scene and started learning about recording, multi-track recording and stuff like that. I eventually got my degree and I was interning with some of the professors that I worked with. And one of the guys that I was interning with knew a guy that had a jingle studio. They were doing radio jingles and he needed somebody, a young kid. And so I started working at the jingle place, basically right as it was the summer of my senior project. I started working and I worked there for about 3 years. And during this whole time, Jim Dickinson was starting the Zebra Ranch, and he sort of brought me in. At this point, the technology was 8-AT machines, which is digital, 8-track digital machines on a VHS tape, and you could lock them together and have multi-track digital. And it was the first sort of professional home recording gear around. And so I started working with Jim at that point, and also doing jingles. And after about 3 years, the jingle, the guy that owned the jingle place and kind of burnt out, and he got out of the business and sold everything. And, at that point I was freelance, and, I've been that way ever since.
Wow, man. That entrepreneurial thing. So back in my hometown, Jody Davis from the Christian band, the Newsboys, is from there. And the only local studio was one of his buddies. And I remember that being all the rage, my first recording, when people were like, can you believe they used 8 ADATs on their recording? 54 tracks. Like, can you believe it? Yeah. And people thought, yeah, it's like super incredible. How do they even do that? It's just totally, you know, insane.
You have to like, for that.
Yeah. And that big rack of the VHR looking things that you'd have to have. ADAT on top of ADAT, yeah.
Oh, God, I hated the ADAT machines. I mean, it was cool because you could sort of get into professional multi-track recording, but they would always eat the tapes. And I opened up so many ADAT machines over the course of time that I spent working on them. And the straw that broke the camel's back for me was, I guess it was around 95 when I graduated from college and started working professionally. And around 99, Jim Dickinson wanted to do a soundtrack. He had done lots of soundtrack work with Ry Cooder in the 70s and 80s. You know, Crossroads was one of the movies that he did the score on.
Where we all learned that Ralph Macchio is the greatest guitar player
ever. Right, exactly. I mean, I think that movie was really, I think a lot of people my age and they grew up in the 80s. That was like a pivotal movie for musicians. You know?
It is when I fell in love with blues. I kind of became fascinated with blues after that movie.
Yeah, it made blues cool to kids of our generation. And so anyway, he was doing a soundtrack and we were doing it on ADAT. It was a small independent film that had really great character actor you've seen in a million movies. He was the ghost in Ghost. Vincent, I think was his name. He had me moving stuff around, you know, and I had to, with ADAT editing, to be able to like move one thing to another place in time, you had to do a lot of math and offset one machine, you know, however much time from the other machine. And so the math itself, you know, was cumbersome, but some of them, some of the math was base 10 math and some of it was base 60 math, you know, based on 60 seconds in a minute. And so after that project, my brain was just like smoking and I was like, screw it. At this point, Pro Tools had come onto the scene and I was like, I'm getting a Pro Tools rig. There's no way I'm going to do this again. And I got a Pro Tools rig and taught myself, you know, how to record on a Pro Tools rig, and that's, you know, that's what I use every day now.
So when you were making that purchase, you know, why did you choose Pro Tools over Cakewalk? I mean, clearly the superior program was Cakewalk. I'm just kidding. Nobody knows what Cakewalk is, but us two probably. So.
I just, you know, at the time I was trying to figure out what was, I mean, they all do similar things in different ways, and for different workflows, but Pro Tools seemed like that was going to stick around, and luckily it still has.
Yeah, I actually did start on Cakewalk. It was wonky. They were all kind of wonky back then, though.
Right, exactly.
A little bit. So, all right. So you've been around. You've produced some great records. Okay. I want to get a few like highlights. Not. I'm not somebody. I don't want you to judge who is good or better. That obviously right. would put you in a weird position. But just as far as like the most fun, the most experimental. What are some like sessions that pop out? Obviously, other than working with me, which was the highlight of everyone's career.
Definitely.
But otherwise, what were some ones you're like, that was wild when we experimented this way, or this was super fun?
Right.
And then I want to get into some business questions.
Cool. Growing up with Cody and Luther, anytime we got a chance to record together was always super fun. You know, we started recording together, at a young age. And so it was always... It's always fun to be able to get in the studio with them. Some highlights include, I was always a real big Zeppelin guy. I got a chance to work alongside Robert Plant. Luther and Cody had toured opening up for Robert Plant's band, the band of Joy, and Patty Griffin was in the band. And Patty and Robert fell in love on tour. And Patty's dad had recently died, and she was writing her next record. And she wanted to work with Luther and Cody. And so she came down to the Zebra Ranch, and we recorded. And she was still dating Robert Plant, and he was kind of, I think he got a co-production credit on that record. And so he was hanging around, and he sang on a couple of songs. And that was just like, and he was super, super cool. He was, sometimes when you meet these people that you idolize, you're disappointed. He was not a disappointment. He was so cool and, really gracious and nice and awesome. So that was, working with Patty in and of itself was an awesome thing, but to have him around as well, that was a lot of fun. When I got to work with, Rod Cooter, when Katrina, hit New Orleans, they did, I forget the organization, but there was like this sort of benefit CD, and Buckwheat Zydeco, was one of the artists. And I guess Rye had been working with him. And so it was Rod Cooter, forget the bass player's name. Jim Keltner on drums and Jim Dickinson on piano, and Buckwheat. And, we did that at the Young Avenue Sounds in Memphis. It took us, LA Don Smith, produced a bunch of all kinds. He produced the Rolling Stones. He worked with Keith Richards. He worked a lot with Rod Cooter. He was the engineer, and, Keltner and Don Smith had all this cartage sent to the studio and rented a bunch of gear from Nashville. It took us 2 days to set up the session. Once we got it going, and this is before anybody came, to get it all plugged in and checked out, and then the session was like maybe 4 hours.
Wow.
It was over. So that was awesome. I had heard stories of Jim working with Rod Cooter, and so to be able to hang out with him, that was a lot of fun. Well, those are some things. It's always, when I got to produce, Southern Avenue, that was fun, to watch a young band sort of like, it's like sort of the dream scenario, get signed. These days, there's not a lot of people getting signed to record deals. And if you're getting signed to a record deal, it's not always the best thing in the world for you,
Right. Yeah.
But, I had done, Ori Naftali, the guitarist in the band, had reached out to me, and they didn't have any money, and he was just starting a new band. It was really the Ori Naftali Blues Band Mark II. He had met Tierney Jackson and her sister, and I found this really cheap studio. A friend of mine had a studio in his backyard and gave it to us for a steal, and we recorded a five song EP that ended up getting picked up, and they got signed to Concord under the Stax emblem. And for me being a Memphian, I would say it was like the gig of my dream, but I never would have dreamed to be able to work on a record for Stax. In my mind, Stax, you know, was done years ago. So that was really fun, you know, for them to get signed and me to be able to continue and complete the record. That was another highlight. So those are some points of interest for me along my career.
In other news, Kevin worked with us, and now he's going to be an accountant. He's reconsidering his life.
Yeah.
After going through that horrendous experience.
This profession is like super humbling, you know, and you just have to try to do your best work, and be super nice to everybody. The person who's your assistant today is going to be hiring you to, in a year or two.
Man, I found that my first A&R guy told me, be careful who you step on the way up, because you'll meet them on the way back down.
That's right.
And it's absolutely true, man.
I mean,
the guy that started as my one roadie is now one of the biggest, like, concert promoters in Texas and Oklahoma, like, deals with billions of dollars of festivals and stuff. And he started out getting my water and tuning my guitar.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Like, you just don't know. I mean, he's way more successful than I'll ever be. So the business, obviously, when you and I got in the business, there was like I call it the Muppet scenario, where the standard rich and famous contracts, you know, you get, you know, people forget in the year 2000, there was like, I don't know, 10 or 12 diamond records, which no one even considers what a diamond record is anymore.
Right.
But, you know, that to me, that was a blip. That wasn't, that was like the housing bubble or the stock market bubble. It wasn't the way the music business had always been.
Right.
And so now things have sort of come back to where I don't think people are in it for money anymore.
Right.
Do you see the sort of survival, not to quote Memphis, but the sort of grit and grind of it, that people are just making their art and hoping they can make enough to make a living? Is that a positive on art, or is it negative? And also, then particularly, how does that affect producers and engineers? You there? Hello? I think I may have lost you. There you are. I lost you for a second.
I'm sorry. I'll start over again. In the 90s, mid-90s when I started, there was a lot of work. And that's just not the way it is these days. Everybody I knew was busy, and now, you know, everybody I know is, you know, scrambling to put things together. Projects that, you know, would come in with like a 3 week long budget. I mean, that never happens anymore. You know, the budgets are so much less. And you got to do more with less in less time. But, you know, and the tools have also somewhat, you know, arguably, improved, to make things go quicker. But, that's one of the reasons I sort of got into doing films, because on a film, you can book a 3 week long project. Not a lot of people are purchasing music. A lot of people are listening to music and streaming music, and I hope that one day that business model will end up being profitable so people could make a living on recordings. But it's gotten to the point now that people just make the record as a promotional item for the tour. Physical is for all intent and purposes dead.
You know? Yeah.
People buy a record at a show like they buy a t-shirt. You know, it's like, you know, just, a novelty piece that, hey, I went to the show. Everybody with a smartphone has access to everything anytime, anywhere. And, so yeah, it has definitely affected, my business. And, a lot of guys that were getting into engineering, when I was, you know, a lot of them are doing something else now. And for some crazy reason, I'm still doing it.
Crazy as in lucky, or like crazy as in you don't know why, like you're questioning your own sanity.
Exactly. But, you know, you have to love it. And like you said, these days, nobody's getting rich off music. I think in a way it sort of really made it, you know, you have to love it to be able to do this, because there's a lot of sacrifices, that you have to make to be able to do this for a living.
Right.
And family, being a big family time being a big part. So it has to be a calling. It has to be a lifestyle, you know, anybody that wants to make money, you know, any young kid is going to get into tech. They're going to get in, you know,
right.
That's the rich and famous now are the nerds, you know, and there's music nerds as well, but,
the nerds shall inherit the earth.
Exactly. They have, long live the nerds.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to Nashville to Memphis. We truly appreciate it. If you enjoy the podcast, go on to your podcast provider on iTunes and give us a rating. Write us a couple sentences telling everyone how great we are. Ratings should be 5 stars and nothing below. I love doing this podcast, but like everything else, it costs money to make. So if you would, to show some support, go to Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, and stream some of our music. We have 7 albums out. And it would mean a lot if you'd share it with your friends and tell everyone else about us, the Jason Lee McKinney Band. And speaking of supporting my music, here's a little sample for you, a song you can sit back and enjoy while you're riding down the road.
One thing, you know, technology has made recording easier on one side. The sort of yin to that yang is there's also the assertion that a lot less talented people can make records. So would you say, has your job gotten easier or harder given these two factors? One, that tech helps make things sound better, but potentially you could be working with less experience, less talented, or even if they're as talented, you're working with them in a shorter amount of time.
Sure. I mean, everybody knows now that, hey, you can fix that, right? And so, back in the day, you just had to be able to sing or, do it a million times. You know, I remember having to beat up vocalists trying to get things just to get stuff that was in tune. And now, you know, if it's close enough, you know, you've got all kinds of, software that can help you out. It's like when you're limited, like when I started out doing four tracks and stuff like that, like I said, the limitations were creatively enriching. You have to figure out how to get everything on four tracks or eight tracks or 24 tracks. And now you have unlimited tracks and unlimited, things at your fingertips to alter the sound. And, so in a way it's easier, in a way it's more difficult, because you have so many options. There's so many things you could do, that it's hard. Sometimes you get paralyzed by the options. But for me, yeah, you know, there's less time. I like to make records fast, anyway. But it always seems like whatever budget or time you have, you end up making the record in that amount of time. If you have more time, then you take more time. If you have less time, then it all magically gets done.
Like your favorite thing is tracking 7 songs in one day. Some jackass wanted you to do that.
The only thing I would prefer it would be like mixing a record in a day.
Yeah, I was just doing it one day. 4 hours is best.
Right, exactly.
The whole thing. All right, so yeah. I got three more questions.
Cool.
One, you have a family, you have kids. A buddy of mine said this. He resisted having kids for years. He was a touring drummer. And he said, I just hated to see the guys that had kids getting on the bus because they seemed so miserable. And now he has a
miserable kid. To leave their families or?
Miserable to leave their family. So, you know, and Sheryl Crow has that quote that I'm miserable 23 hours a day and then I get on stage.
Right, exactly.
But,
exactly.
You know, the balance of kids, how has that changed your workflow? And this sort of ties into, is that something that is, made your work better? Do you feel like you're better since you've had kids? Because I feel like I'm a better songwriter since I've had kids.
Right. Yeah, well, it definitely gives you more perspective as a human being. So there would be a bigger depth of material to draw upon as a songwriter. I could totally see that. Yeah, you know, it's all about balance. You know, when getting into this thing, you know, you have to really throw yourself into it, and there's always going to be somebody that out there that'll work that extra hour or that later, you know, night. So when you first start out, you got to be the one that's going to outwork everybody else and stay until 3 a.m. Then when, as you mature and maybe you have a significant other, girlfriend, boyfriend, wife, then you start to have to learn balance if you want to keep those relationships intact. You know, you can't spend all your time in the studio. You do have to, spend time with the people in your life. And then when you have kids, that's the ultimate, you know, you've got a living thing that you have to take care of. So, in a way, you know, it adds a lot of pressure, adds a lot of, incentive, to get out there and hustle and make things happen. It makes everything a little more real. Up until the point that I had a family, you know, I was just kind of sort of carefree about, oh, something's going to pop up. And now, you know, as you get older, you buy a house, you have a mortgage, you have car payments, you know, your kids got to go to school. So you really gotta, you know, some things that you might do for free or nothing just to show your enthusiasm to be a part of the team when you were younger. They're like, I just can't afford to do those things, you know.
Not in your vocabulary when you're young, investment portfolio.
Right. Totally. So, you know, adulting can be a drag, but I mean, it's also, you know, the most creative thing you can do as a human being is to create another human being and be an influence on their life. So, in a way, you know, being a dad is more, even more fulfilling creatively, than the studio.
Wow. So that's a pretty brilliant answer, man. I never thought about it being creative like that, but it is. I mean, it's, yeah, that's a pretty brilliant answer. All right. So last of the non-serious questions, and I got a big serious one that I ask everyone. So what advice would you give somebody getting into it other than don't? Because that's, I always have to say that because that's everyone's first advice is, well, first of all, don't do it. But so a young engineer producer, what would be your advice? What is like a key takeaway that this has really made my career go the way it has?
I, you know, don't be an asshole.
What is it? Chris Pratt just said that in his speech. Don't be a turd.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, that's what I tell everybody. You know, like we talked about, you've got to always be humble. You've got to always be gracious. People, you know, there's, Maya Angelou had a great quote, you know, and I'm probably going to massacre it, but it's something like, people don't remember, people may or may not remember what you did, but they'll always remember how you made them feel. So it's all about relationships. So cultivate relationships, with the most talented people in the room. And always, you know, always be kind and empathetic. Artists are, you know, can be really sensitive people. So you have to be really cautious as a engineer and a producer, how you treat people. Jim Dickinson had a great quote, misery sticks to the tape. So, you know, have fun. I mean, it's supposed to be fun. When you're in the studio, you know, to me, it's the biggest rush and it's the highest high, and, trying to find a balance in life also, because, after you do the big project, there's always, the big letdown. Jim called it post-production syndrome. So knowing that, you know, after you feel incredible from recording your new EP or record or whatever, eventually you're going to feel like crap. And once being, you know, once the production is done, because it's so much fun.
Right.
So being kind, to people, creating relationships, and trying to learn a balance in life. That's what I would, the advice I would give people starting out.
Awesome. I got one more question. This one's super serious, man. It's heavy. It's super heavy.
All right.
Everyone, you got ready? Okay. Everyone's got songs that they're a little embarrassed that they like, that they only like in the shower or like when they're alone. And I ask people to just fess up and like, imagine yourself, you're Catholic and you're walking through the confessional and you're going to, for the first time, expose to the Lord and the world that song that you've never admitted in front of anyone that you just love.
Oh man, as a kid, I loved Air Supply. I just loved Air Supply. You know, I'm all out of love.
Wow.
I love that.
I can't, I only think of Will Ferrell and Chris Kattan now when they're behind the music when they started making out. But
yeah. No, I was you know, a child of the 80s for sure, and you know, that's about as served. I haven't listened to it in years, but I guess that's a guilty pleasure of mine. Growing up as a kid, I was into Air Supply.
Wow, you know, in that same era, I always try to confess something myself. I traded a neighborhood kid. Do you remember Matthew Wilde? Ain't Nothing Gonna Break My Stride?
Yeah.
That song?
Yeah.
I traded my Van Halen 1984
for
his Matthew Wilde because I thought this Matthew Wild guy, he's got something going. People are going to forget about this Van Halen band. This Matthew Wild, he's going to be around for a long time. So it wasn't really guilty pleasure. It was just a massive mistake. My A&R skills were not honed at 8 years old. So anyway.
Exactly.
All right, well, I'll end the podcast.